Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
One, two, one, two, three, four.
For the hardest working man in show business, it was all about the one. This is Soundcheck. I'm the bassist and composer Christian McBride, sitting in for John Schaefer. Today, the life and music of the legendary Mr. James Brown. And later, some James Brown classics performed live in the studio, coming at you from a new band that we're calling the Junior JBs. But first, the Godfather of Soul was known to lose as much as 7 pounds during each of his performances. For people who saw James Brown perform live, this probably comes as no surprise. He was electrifying, terrifying, and absolutely wild on stage. Later in the show, we'll be joined by someone who was a part of many of those performances, former James Brown sideman Fred Thomas. But underneath his showmanship, James Brown struggled to maintain complete control over his act, his career, and his life. As chronicled in the new biography, The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. The book's author is R.J. Smith, former senior editor at Los Angeles Magazine, and he joins me now from NPR West in Culver City, California. R.J., welcome to Soundcheck.
Oh, Christian, it's great to be here. Hi.
So nice to finally talk to you. I know we've been playing email and phone tag for quite some time. Finally great to talk to you.
Agree. Totally.
Why did you call your book The One?
Well, lots of reasons. I mean, every time I ask a question about James Brown or talk to musicians in particular, in the band, outside the band, you hear that concept. And everybody I talk to has a different angle on what it means, but it was Brown's ground zero. It was kind of a philosophy of music for him and a philosophy of life, too, I think.
Yes. Let's hear one example of what we're talking about, that emphasis on the one. Let's listen to one of James Brown's biggest hits.
Get past the people, get past the hitman. Get on that night. I want to get on the good foot.
James Brown, Get on the Good Foot, from 1972. There are so many examples of The One, that music that comes down, that beat, right on the first beat at the beginning of every bar. But what does The One mean to you?
Well, yeah, as you say, it's first of all hitting that beat two ways, maybe. Sometimes really strong, like that song, and sometimes the opposite. He left it blank. You know, he left this big hole for you as a listener to fall into and then comes in later. So you're feeling it. You're just not hearing something. Beyond that, you know, I think it was like his secret sauce. It was the secret that he knew that he always was going to have over any listener, anybody in the band. You know, when I talked to Bootsy Collins, and obviously a brilliant musician, after a show, Brown would take Bootsy aside and say, listen, that was pretty good, son, but I got to tell you, you just weren't on the one. And the one was the thing he always held over your head as a musician. You did okay, but next time, let's try to get it on the one.
Well, ironically, the man who played bass on Get on the Good Foot is here with us later this afternoon. We'll talk to him later on in the hour. But James Brown once said, I was born to the downbeat, and I can tell you without question, there was no pride in it. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, he was relating it to the one again, and what it meant was that he was born in the most abject kind of poverty imaginable. He was born out, you know, in the middle of the woods, basically in the swampy woodland of central Western South Carolina, and his dad was working in the turpentine, tapping the turpentine in the trees. His mom was sometimes and sometimes not around. He really raised himself as a boy. His friends were the bugs that lived under the shacks he would live in. He and his dad and an aunt walked from Barnwell, South Carolina, into Augusta when he was about nine. He was a very poor, and when he got to Augusta, he lived in the house of his of Aunt Hanson, Honey Washington. Hanson was her real name. Everybody called her Honey, and she ran a bordello. They sold bootleg liquor from there. They sold everything else from there, and that's how Brown grew up. Most of all, he grew up on the streets of Augusta, Georgia.
Who were some of the people who you spoke with when it comes to when it came to James Brown's early life and his childhood?
Well, I spoke to some folks who grew up with him. Leon, the Burner Austin, was one of them. I was one of the last people to speak to Leon before he died. He was somebody that helped teach Brown music and grew up with him in the part of Augusta, Georgia called the Terry. I spoke to some other people who went to school with him. Henry Stalling, a man who's still alive. He lives up in Harlem. Mr. Stalling went to that school that Brown went to. He became his hairdresser, his aide-de-camp. He was a man who was quick to defend Brown when Brown needed defending. And lots of folks.
This is Christian McBride, and for John Schaefer, we're talking with R.J. Smith, author of The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. A lot of people might remember James Brown's run-ins with the law toward the end of his life. He spent a very well-publicized couple of years in prison for assault and battery with intent to kill, and was also arrested on domestic violence charges. What role do you think his childhood played in those later incidents?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the thing to think about when we think about his run-ins with the law and his criminal record, you can't excuse anything that he did. He was a violent man. He used his fists with band members, with women in his life. At the same time, it didn't happen in a vacuum. He was brought up in a very violent way. His father was violent. He had to fight his way. He was a short fellow. He was so poor, the kids in his school made fun of him. He was sent home from school for having insufficient clothing, the teachers said. He was wearing burlap sacks to school. He learned some bad lessons from this, which he carried over to the rest of his life, for sure.
Yes. Early in James Brown's musical life, of course, he was in a very popular group called the Flames, which later became the Famous Flames. What did you learn about the early formation of the Flames?
Well, Augusta is right there on the Savannah River. It's a big, hot, urban place. And then after Brown, as a teenager, got out of prison in Georgia for breaking into cars to steal clothing, he was released under orders that he live in the town just outside of the prison he was released from, or the boys' youth facility, really, a small town in the northern mountains of Georgia called Toccoa. Now, Toccoa is about as different from Augusta as the mountains are from the sea or something. It's a cooler, mountainous, slower-paced place, and I'm sure the music was very different there that Brown heard. I think he probably got more into gospel there than he had it growing up in Augusta, and he came under the influence and the friendship of a very great man named Bobby Byrd. And many people say, no Bobby Byrd, there would be no James Brown. Bobby Byrd Brown lived with Byrd's family when he got out of jail, and Byrd was an excellent singer and musician of many instruments himself, and invited Brown into his band. And over the time, one could say that Brown took over the band and kind of pushed Byrd aside a little bit.
Now, their first recording, which was Please, 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 was a very nice quote from the book. You say the song is like a very old cage, a strange new bird. What did you mean by that?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's a very simple, haunting, beautiful song, basic triplets and You can hear all kinds of familiar doo-wop records that were popular at the time, and the blues in there. And at the same time, what Brown is doing with it, you know, something so deep and simple in a way, all, you know, the dozens of times he just says please over, and the amazing intense vocal that he puts on some very basic music, made it something old and something that we'd never heard before at the same time.
There's a great story when he took that song to Sid Nathan at King Records. Mr. Nathan said, well, you don't say anything but please. You just say please the whole song. The song has no lyrics.
But you know,
we see what happened with the song. Let's listen to a little bit of Please, Please, Please.
Please, 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 please.
James Brown and the Famous Flames, Please, Please, Please. This is Christian McBride, in for John Schaefer. We're talking with R.J. Smith, author of The One, The Life and Music of James Brown, which is out today. You can find a link to buy it on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. R.J., in James Brown's early career, he had some history with Little Richard. And you talk about that a lot in the book, and it's talk a little bit about Brown and Little Richard.
Yeah, that it's fascinating. Little Richard was a couple years older and was playing in Toccoa. He had some records out that weren't hits, so he was playing a small town like Toccoa one night. And what Brown did more than once was chat up the guy who was in town at the show and say, listen, I got a group here too. We'd love to come up on stage and perform with you. And Little Richard was too smart to let James Brown or let a stranger come up on the stage and perform with him. But he said, listen, I'll tell you what. I'm going to take a break in a few minutes. Why don't you guys come up and perform then? So Brown and the Flames came up on the stage. And Little Richard, to his ever-living credit, saw the talent right there and said, listen, whoever you got as a manager, let me give you the name of my manager. You guys should call him. And they called him, and shortly after that, Brown and his band were living in Macon, where Little Richard was from. Also, Brown clearly modeled his hairstyle on a number of people, a great singer named Billy Wright, but also clearly Little Richard. He was a short man, Brown was, and he wanted a couple of extra inches of hair to make sure people knew where he was.
One of the great albums in the history of American music is James Brown's first live album at the Apollo, Live at the Apollo from 1962. But he got a lot of pushback from King Records. talk a little bit about that.
You're absolutely right. The man who ran King, Sid Nathan, was the classic kind of guy that built the record industry. He was short, fat, cigar-smoking guy with chili stains on his tie. And Sid thought he knew better than anybody. He had a really strong gut, as they say, as did James Brown, of course. He didn't think Please, Please, Please should be released. He definitely didn't think a lot. He thought, you know, Brown was urging him to do a live recording of the show, and Sid thought, these are songs your fans have already heard. What are you talking about? Very few live records had been made at that point. And even after Brown raised the money himself and paid for the recording of that album, even then Sid refused to put it out. And only as an afterthought, as a tax write-off almost, did Nathan finally put it out. And then came the storm. huge hit.
Yes. Let's listen to a little bit of Live at the Apollo.
And believe me, I'm a person. And believe me.
James Brown and the Famous Flames, I'll Go Crazy, from Live at the Apollo. Soundcheck listeners, we want to hear from you. What made James Brown, James Brown? For you, what was the essence of JB? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or leave a message on the Soundcheck webpage at WNYC.org/soundcheck. In a moment, we'll continue our conversation about the Godfather of Soul with my guest, author R.J. Smith, plus James Brown's longtime bassist, Fred Thomas, joins in the conversation. This is Soundcheck.
Yourself and nobody else, you gotta live.
This is Soundcheck. I'm the bassist and composer Christian McBride, sitting in for John Schaefer. We continue our conversation now about the Godfather of Soul, James Brown. I'm joined again by author R.J. Smith, whose James Brown biography called The One is out today. And joining me here in the studio is Fred Thomas, longtime bassist for James Brown and one of my earliest influences. Mr. Thomas, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you, Chris. How you doing, man?
Oh, man. Sitting across from you is just, this makes my year. Folks, you got to know, one of the first bass solos I ever learned was this man's solo from More Peas.
Tell the story, Chris. You know what I mean?
Folks,
absolutely.
This man has played a whole lot of bass for a lot of years. Fred, how did you first get the gig with James Brown? 1971, correct?
Yep. 1971, Chris. What happened, my band was playing at Small Paradise. Yeah. And at the time, Big Wilt Chamberlain owned Small Paradise. So we had, you know, that little turnabout thing with the Commodores and everybody. You make that little circuit thing, you know. So we was playing that. James came in. You know, Sex Machine was a hot record out for him at the time. And they had a party up in Harlem there somewhere. And he dropped in with his entourage, man. And people said, James, come up and sing a song, you know, da-da-da. So anyway, Brown came up, you know, the band can't play my song. They can't play my song, man. The people said, oh, they play anything, you know, they play anything. Okay. So he came up, and he performed Sex Machine. Of course, my band, man, we did everything, you know, just where it's supposed to be done, you know, and with the hits and everything. So he did the song. He did all of the licks and the hits and the ending and everything was bam. As soon as he finished singing, he told Mr. Bobbitt, hide the whole band. That's how we got out, man. The whole rhythm section, high them all, you know. So that's how
wow.
We hooked up, man. You know.
Talk about James Brown as a band leader. What was he like?
Well, James Brown as a band leader, like a lot of people say, man, James Brown, you know, like, you know, not in an offensive way. He was a madman, man, because like, he wanted everything like he wanted. Sometimes he might come in, you know, to a rehearsal or something, you know, and he come in and then these days he come in like nothing pleases him, you know. And some days he come in, that's it, y'all kicking. So other days he come in, we ain't playing nothing, you know. And so you had to get yourself prepared for his mood, what mood he is in the day, you know. And what mood he is in that day, you know, when that. And then sometimes he said, the band, you know, like on stage sometimes, he come back and say, band can't find the one. They can't find the one. Where's the one, Mr. Tom? They don't know the one. The cats can't play. That's what they don't even know where the one is. How can they play? You know, but after a teacher and a motivator, man, you know, he's unheard of, man. You know, you can't even describe it, man, because he's magnificent. Cats say, I can't read a note of music, but, you know, I hear it in the arrangements. And, you know, like, just this magnificent mind of his, what's in his head, man, and what he hears and feel without even putting it down on paper or having anybody write it out, you know.
Yeah.
He hears and he remembers it, man, and put it there. And then when you play it wrong that night, he finds you. You know? Because he remembers, man, you know.
Coming out your pay.
You coming out your pay and took
That's
it.
Right.
And took it. You're going to pay, you know.
Hey, RJ, want to jump in on that?
Yeah, tell me about a time. I'd love to hear Mr. Thomas R.J. Smith here. I'd love to hear about a time that he find you, or what kinds of things did he find people for?
Well, one of my biggest finds, R.J., and I always tell people this one, you know, it's called James have a certain amount of pride. You know, you might get away with a little mishap, you know, if ain't nobody in the audience that he is really trying to, you know, show off to. And this particular night, he was doing Georgia, right? And Quincy Jones was sitting in the front row, you know, at the concert. So we were doing Georgia. I didn't miss the note. I almost missed it and kind of like slid into it. You know what I mean? Man, he went to popping them fives at me. Walked over to it and managed to read the Bible, and take it. $50, take it. I want it coming out of his pay. Take it. You know, somebody might let you slide, but take this one. Man, I always remember that one, RJ, you know. But
when you say popping those fives, tell people what that means.
Every time you pop five fingers at you, that's $5.
$5.
And sometimes you get good at it, you pop both of them at the same time, making it 10. You know, it's 10. Make it easy for you. You know what I mean? Yeah, man.
We have a member of the extended James Brown family on the phone. We want to bring him in here. Our dear friend Harry Weinger, award-winning producer and James Brown distant son. What's happening, Harry?
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Hey, Harry. What's up, man? Harry.
Hey, Fred. How are you?
I'm fine, man. How are you?
Good.
What you got for us, Harry? Say a few words about Mr. Brown.
Hey, he never fined me, but he did test me. And I'll tell you, you know, we often call each other in the James Brown circle by, you know, with the Mr. in front, Mr. Thomas, Mr. McBride, Mr. Smith.
Right.
And Mr. Brown always commanded that respect because it was a respect thing. And he did it in the office, he did it on the road. And Fred, you know, he did it on the bus and on stage. So one time I was speaking with Mr. Brown on the telephone about his catalog, which is, you know, my gig here. And he said, "You can call me James." And I said, "Man, that don't sound right." In my head, I'm thinking, that does not sound right.
He set you up.
And I said, "Mr. Brown, I'm sorry, but I just can't do that." Man, I was good from then on.
That's right.
That's a respectful man. See, that man got some sense. You know?
That's what he said. Right. Yeah, Harry, thank you so much for calling in, and I'll see you on the bus back to Montclair.
Yeah, all right, fellas. All right, good luck, man.
Good talking to you, Harry.
Harry Weinger, ladies and gentlemen. Let's hear a little bit of Make It Funky, which features the great Fred Thomas on bass.
What you gonna play now?
Bobby, I don't know, but whatsoever I play, it's got to be funky.
Yeah.
One, two, three, make it funky.
Make It Funky, James Brown from 1971. This is Christian McBride, and for John Schaefer, we're talking with R.J. Smith, author of The One, The Life and Music of James Brown, and we're also here with the great bassist, Fred Thomas. R.J., I want to ask you, this music is so funky, is so danceable, but Mr. Brown fell upon hard times during the disco era. The irony in that, talk about that a little bit.
you nailed it, the irony. I mean, here's a man, without what James Brown did, there couldn't have been disco music. There couldn't have been this pop explosion of dance music that brought so many people together, different parts of life, different races, all in this pop moment. But for lots of reasons, having to do with business politics, having to do with age maybe, having to do with this idea that disco was a novelty, something new, but we all knew James Brown maybe. He never caught on successfully to the disco bandwagon. He tried to make some disco records, but the records of his that were the hits in that era were the funkiest records, just being James Brown. But I think he really, interviews at the time, I think he really resented the fact that he felt kind of thrown over by audiences as they got onto the disco thing.
Yeah. On the phone now, we have another person deep within the James Brown family, Mr. Alan Leeds, who's been a source of information for anyone who wants to know anything about James Brown. Oh, what's happening, Alan?
Hey, Mr. McBride, Mr. Smith, Mr. Thomas.
What's up, Alan Reed?
What's up, Brother Thomas?
I should have said, Mr. How you doing, Mr. Reed?
Now, you know, it's a funny thing about the Mr. thing. It occurred to me when you were talking about the fine system, that when you did something that deserved a fine, Mr. Brown all of a sudden discovered your first name again real quick.
when he was
watching them fives, it wasn't Mr. Thomas, it was Fred.
Fred Thomas, give him a five. That's right. Yes, sir. You forgot all that Mr. stuff, finesse.
But, you know, talking about disco, too, just to segue into what you guys were just kicking it about, it occurs to me he couldn't make a good disco record because what it really meant, as RJ just explained, without James Brown, it wouldn't have been disco. But the irony is disco was about taking James Brown and watering it down. And that's the one thing he couldn't do to himself was water down his music because it was just too personal and too passionate. And there's no way to distill that into the kind of mechanical thing that disco became.
Mm-hmm. Very good point, Brother Leeds. You also mentioned in a documentary about Mr. Brown where you mentioned how during that period, a lot of people who had great live shows suffered because all of a sudden it became hipper to go to a club and dance to records as opposed to going to live shows.
Yeah, and that really was as much a cultural thing that maybe it really didn't have anything to do with James Brown or who was making the records as much as it just was the cultural habits. I mean, it was we had gone through the whole Vietnam and Kent State and all of that earlier on, and all of a sudden disco came along, and it was cool to get dressed up again and comb your hair and you know and go to a club and dance, and it was like it was almost as if people were past the stage of wanting to sit in an arena with bad sound systems, listening to bands, you know, smoking weed all night long. It was like, okay, let's instead of, they traded the weed for other things that were really a lot more connected to going to a club and dancing your ass off, excuse the expression, instead of sitting in a concert hall or in a theater or even in a traditional nightclub and watching entertainment. It was almost like you became the entertainment. And in order to do that, you needed this kind of anonymous, steady pulse of music going through a system in a club that could really be high-tech because it didn't depend on musical instruments. It was totally produced and synthetic.
In the words of James Brown, Alan Leeds, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a big round of applause.
Yes,
Alan, thank you for calling in, my brother. We will talk very soon.
Good to talk to you guys, and congrats to RJ on getting this book out. We talked about this book many years ago, and we talked during the course of it, and you know, I'm glad to have a real bio out there for my little James Brown reader to be a companion to.
Yes, yes, indeed. Mr. Leeds, you're all over this book. Thank you so much.
RJ, in 1985, James Brown had a huge comeback with Living in America from the movie Rocky IV. Now, what did that hit mean to him?
Yeah, it put him back on the charts in a huge way with a huge different audience, I think, maybe than he'd been totally reaching before. You know, it got him a white baby boomer audience that stayed loyal to him, I think, for a number of years after that. Another thing about that record that he liked was that when he was in the first class of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with a lot of other greats, Little Richard and Elvis and Roy Orbison, I believe, and many other people, he was the only founding member of that class that had a hit on the charts at that time, and that meant a lot to him. At the same time, it's the least funky James Brown hit ever recorded.
Here's Living in America. James Brown with Living in America. Gentlemen, sadly, that's all we have time for. RJ's new biography of James Brown, called The One, is out today. To my guest RJ Smith and bassist Fred Thomas, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, man, Chris, it has been a pleasure, man.
Pleasure
thank
was ours.
Honor and a pleasure. Yeah, my pleasure.
Coming up next, it's time for the Junior JBs, my all-star James Brown cover band, to take the stage. This is Soundcheck.